On this episode, Alex looks back at more than 30 Skeptico interviews and how his view of the skeptical community has evolved.
You know, when I started this journey, I was really expecting a genuine debate, a battle of ideas, you know, people warring over the evidence. But that's not what I found. What I found was a lot of frustrated researchers who were facing a well-organized, aggressive, skeptical community that's managed to change the rules of the game when it comes to how some certain kinds of controversial science research is done.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and today on Skeptico, I want to use this time to mark somewhat of a turning point for me and for Skeptico. You know, I started this podcast almost a year ago as a personal journey of discovery, one person's attempt to sort through the claims being made by skeptics on one side and controversial researchers on the other who are exploring some of the questions and issues that I was most interested in. As many of you know, that journey has led me to talk to some of the leading skeptics, folks like Michael Shermer, Stephen Novella, James Alcock, James Randi, and others. It's also led me to talk to leading researchers like Rupert Sheldrick, Dean Radin, Raymond Moody, Stephen Swartz, Ed and Emily Kelly, and many others. You know, when I started this journey, I was really expecting a genuine debate, a battle of ideas, you know, people warring over the evidence. But that's not what I found. What I found was a lot of frustrated researchers who were facing a well-organized, aggressive, skeptical community that's managed to change the rules of the game when it comes to how some certain kinds of controversial science research is done. It's made it nearly impossible for folks to get funding or to find an academic position or even publish without encountering just a firestorm of criticism. So now that I've pretty much given up on the skeptical position and looking to the skeptical position as providing any real insight into these topics, I thought I'd use this episode to point out what I think are the three biggest failings of the skeptical community. And they all center around how skeptics deal with the research. In today's episode, I'm going to show you how the skeptical community doesn't support the research, doesn't read the research, and doesn't do the research. And then I'm going to tell you what I'm going to do about it. For starters, I want to try and gain some perspective on this whole topic. Imagine if we could find someone who wasn't engaged in this debate to begin with and was coming in fresh and new. What's the first question you might ask? Well, I think it is, where's the research? I mean, these are big questions. Questions like, what is the nature of human consciousness? Where did we come from? What happens to us after we die? I mean, these are the most fundamental questions that science could possibly answer. Surely a significant portion of the billions of dollars that we spend every year on science research is being applied to directly answering these questions, right? Well, as you know, that's not the case. But is that really what the public wants? I mean, if you went out and asked the average, well-educated person whether it's more important for the National Institute of Health to spend $3 million with Oregon State to find out whether sheep are gay, that's money that the NIH is spending right now this minute, by the way, or whether or not they'd like to see that money spent with, let's say, Gary Schwartz at the University of Arizona, who's trying to find out if mediums can really talk to your deceased relatives. Well, most people, I suspect, would vote against the sheep. But the public doesn't get a vote. The ruling elites of science control where the money goes, and that's where the skeptical community comes in. They represent a strong group that advocates a certain position. And maybe I'm a little naive, but I think that was one of the biggest surprises to me in this whole experience of Skeptico, is learning just how resistant skeptics are to research in this area. If researchers are discovering that, hey, maybe there's some possibility that our consciousness survives death, I mean, we're doing near-death experience research, people have a cardiac arrest, we have no way of explaining any kind of brain activity, and yet they come back and report these strange experiences, and it happens over and over again. I guess I just assumed that the skeptical community would want to support the research, would want to see funds go in that direction, if for no other reason than to prove that it's not true. I assume this because I always thought of the skeptical community as being pro-science, and I always associated pro-science with being pro-science funding.
So when you step back and you look at how important these issues are, and you look at how much the public is in favor of finding answers to them, you wonder, where's the proportionality? Where's all the money being spent? And that's, again, where the skeptical community comes in. So you ask skeptics. You ask folks like Stephen Novello or Richard Wiseman, what is their position on the funding of these controversial issues? You get answers something like this.
It's not that good research isn't being done because the environment isn't friendly. The environment isn't friendly because there's no meat there, because scientists look at that area and they don't see the theoretical or empirical justification for putting resources into it.
That was Stephen Novello. Now let's hear from Richard Wiseman.
If time and again you went searching for unicorns and you didn't find them, just how many adventures, how many journeys do you go on before you say, well, they're probably not there and I'm not going to waste any more time?
Okay, let's leave aside the fact that there's tons of great data, because we'll get to that in a minute. And let's focus instead on the money. There has been virtually zero public money spent on exploring these issues. I mean, a mere drop in the bucket compared to the public science budget in general. So for these guys to suggest that we've exhausted our search and we should pack up our tent and go home, we're looking for unicorns, is just the height of hypocrisy, especially from a guy like Richard Wiseman. I mean, he's interested in quirky psychology, whether he can fool people into changing the color of his shirt while he does a magic trick. And that's fine. I guess that's okay. But I'm much more interested in the survival of my consciousness than I am as to whether he can do a card trick. And for him to suggest that public money should be diverted away from the study of human consciousness, when we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of understanding it and haven't funded it at all, it just seems completely ridiculous to me. But that's not the end of it. Here's the second part of the same argument that you hear from these guys.
If there was really solid evidence of any psi phenomenon, people, scientists, both physicists and psychologists and neuroscientists, would be all over it.
That was again Stephen Novella. Now let's hear from noted skeptic James Alcock.
You could come up with good data that showed there's something to the paranormal. Parapsychologists would be trampled by psychologists and physicists and so on, rushing to the study of it.
Okay, so this is the second part of the same argument. Hey, the reason we don't support funding into controversial science like this is because there's nothing there. And the reason we know there's nothing there is because no one's found anything. Well, the absurdity of this argument ties right into my second point, and that's that they don't read the research that's being done. The tiny little trickle of research that does get published gets ignored, dismissed, attacked unnecessarily. So to support this, let me give you some examples that we've explored right here on Skeptico. The first one I'd point to is one that you've heard me talk about before. It happened way back in one of the early episodes of Skeptico in my conversation with Dean Radin about the work he had done in the presentiment experiments. Many of you might recall that this is an experiment where he revealed some people have the ability to actually have a precognitive experience something before it actually happens. As strange as that might sound, the experiment's been replicated at least 9 times by 3 different labs around the world. So on Skeptico, we sought a critical analysis of this experiment. And here's what happened. There's a noted skeptic named Ray Hyman who claims to have read more parapsychology research reports than anyone, claims to be the expert on these kind of experiments. So he was on the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe show with Stephen Novella, and he made some really rather extremely harsh criticisms of Dean Radin in a very scoffing, cynical way. He claimed, you know, there's no replication of his work, even though at the time there had already been these 9 replications I talked about. But even worse, he claimed that Radin had done this post hoc analysis of his data and had changed the baseline of the different experiments that he'd done. I noticed that on one hand he said there wasn't any replication, then he said on the 3 different replications he had changed the baseline. But leave all that besides. I mean, here's a guy who's standing forward as a well-credentialed scientist who's really looked into this, and he's there telling a large skeptical audience that there's nothing to these guys' claims because I've looked into them and they're false, they're phony, he's fooling with the data. It was just a completely erroneous claim, completely false. You can recall that we talked to Dean Radin and he pointed out not only had he done the replications and other people had done the replications, but that he had published a meta-analysis where he'd combined the results of the three replications that he himself had done and found that they were highly statistically significant. As I say, I've mentioned this story before, and I bring it up again, not just because it's a great story, and it was really a boost for me to go forward with Skeptico because I felt like I was really getting someplace, but it also demonstrates how skeptics just don't read. You know, so I keep pounding the drum on this, and by now you'd think one of the skeptical listeners out there who have commented just frequently about this claim that I've made because I've attacked one of their heroes, Stephen Novella, who I really haven't attacked, just pointed out that he didn't have his facts right in this case. But you'd think someone would say, you know, I've gone ahead and read that report by Radin, and it doesn't say what you said it does. Or I've read it, and hey, it does say what you said it does. But I haven't heard anyone who's actually read it. Because skeptics don't read reports, research reports that is, that don't fit with their existing belief system. It's just too uncomfortable. Let me give you a second example. Stephen Schwartz is a very, very interesting researcher that I spoke to a while back. And unfortunately for me, I didn't have a chance to really read his books before I interviewed him. I read some articles, I read some what some other people had to say, but really didn't have a chance to read his books. Well, that was my loss, because after the interview, I had a chance to go back and read a couple of those books. Here's a guy that in one of his first books, The Secret Vaults of Time, who carefully documents 100 years of archaeological remote viewing research. Now, if you think I'm kidding, just go read Secret Vaults of Time. It's all there, case after case, well-documented. Many of them in a research setting. I went ahead and Googled a lot of the links or a lot of the names that are mentioned there. It's all there. It's all substantiated over and over again by multiple people who've been involved. There's really no argument with it. But that's just the first book that Stephen Schwartz wrote. The next one he did was even more amazing. He followed up his archaeological remote viewing experience by conducting a major archaeological dig of his own called the Alexandria Project, and he used remote viewers extensively to find major, major archaeological finds in ancient Alexandria, and the results were truly amazing. But to this day, I've never read any serious skeptical response to his work. Why? Because it's uncomfortable. It doesn't fit. It challenges the existing paradigm that skeptics work in. You want a third example? I'll make it brief because I've talked about it many times before, and I'm sure to talk about it many times again. But that's the work of Dr. Rupert Sheldrick. And I bring up this example because it further points out just how a little bit of probing into the superficial arguments that skeptics make yield just kind of amazing results. I mean, the state of things when I first looked into Rupert Sheldrick's work into whether dogs know when their owners were coming home was more or less a stalemate between Sheldrick, who had claimed to have done a bunch of research and published some very impressive books and papers on it, and this other gentleman named Richard Wiseman, who was standing on the other side saying, you know, I've really debunked that. And his claim to have debunked it was picked up and just echoed over and over and over again by every skeptic you'd ever hear. And that is so often the case with skeptics. They don't do any original research. They just parrot back what they've heard that sounds good and fits into their view of the world. So we had the opportunity to interview Richard Wiseman and talk to him. And to my surprise, he admitted the data that he collected really did conform to the published reports that Sheldrick had made. Well, this totally undercuts the most serious counterclaims against Sheldrick's work and really leaves Sheldrick's claims of dogs that know when their owners are coming home really virtually unchallenged. Yet it's interesting to note that when I talked to James Randi a few weeks later or maybe a few months later, he was still pounding the drum how Wiseman had really exposed Sheldrick's experiments as not being valid. I think Randi needs one of those free iTunes subscriptions to Skeptico to get caught up on the latest research. Okay, so those are three examples, but I could give you many more that we've talked about on Skeptico. There's the whole area of near-death experience, and you recall we talked to Dr. Raymond Moody, really the researchers that started all that and established the term near-death experience. There's also the work of Ian Stevenson on reincarnation, incredibly compelling work that we've talked about here on the Skeptico show. So given that we've established the data is out there, at least enough to raise the curiosity of an open-minded skeptic, of a scientist, of any scientist who's really curious. So given that, let's look back at the first point, the point that was made by Stephen Novella and James Alcock about, you know, if there was anything here, research would just rush in. Now, look back at that and compare it with the data that I've just talked about here. Hey, Dean Radin's work. Where's the rush? Where's the rush for everyone to answer that question? Or Stephen Schwartz and archaeological remote viewing. Hey, there's well-documented cases. Where's the just rush of people in there behind that to follow that up? Doesn't exist. Or any of this other stuff. Gary Schwartz's work in mediums. No one else is doing that work. Why not? So the proposition that one, we shouldn't fund this work because there's nothing there. We're chasing unicorns. It's just completely ridiculous. The second point is that there isn't any good data is equally just not founded by anyone who scratches the surface of this area and does any reading at all. Okay, so they don't support the research that would answer the questions that most all of us want answered, the big questions. And they do a very poor job of reading the research that does get through. But the third, and in some respects, the biggest failing of the skeptical community is that they don't do research. They don't even do any personal discovery. And in many cases, they're in a very good position to do research. So I thought I'd start out by giving you a small example of a personal experience I had of this, because, again, as I pointed out before, maybe I'm a little bit naive or was a little bit naive when I started Skeptico, because I really thought that research into these topics by the skeptics, even just kind of everyday casual personal discovery kind of research, would be at the core of their skepticism. I expect to see a lot of people say, yes, I've done this, you know, personal discovery, and here's what I found, all these fakers and frauds, you know. But what I found is something more like this. So I'm doing an interview a few months back with Stephen Novella, host of Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. So I'm preparing for the interview. I see what interviews he's had. Now, most skeptics never interview anyone from the other side, any proponents, any believers in Psi or any investigators of that. Stephen Novella doesn't anymore, but a few years ago, he at least had a couple in there, and he does occasionally, but really not very much. So anyways, I go and going to do a little research. I look into his archives. Lo and behold, I find in December of 2005, he had done this interview with a psychic detective, and this person had, you know, really kind of impressive credentials, had worked with some detectives who had actually published and said, yeah, this person really did help us. They really know what they're doing. So Novella has her on the show for an interview. Here's how it starts.
Okay, so joining us now is Jan Helen McGee. She is a psychic detective who investigated the case of the murderer of Mark Arnold.
Okay, and then they chat a little bit about the case and about Steve goes ahead and lectures her on science. So something skeptics love to do is kind of lecture people about science. But anyways, they get to some point and then they have some kind of agreement on this test they're going to do.
Let me ask you a question. If we wanted to subject you to some very basic common sense controls to see if we could validate the results of your investigations, would you be willing to do that?
I would be willing to do anything that was moving forward for good.
Okay, so it's set. They talk a little bit more, and then they wrap up the show.
I look forward to working with you in the future. It sounds like we have an agreement that you will do a investigate a murder case under our observation, so we can basically tally your accuracy. We'll be in touch off the air with the details for that, but that is excellent. I'm looking forward to doing that.
So this is great, right? I mean, here's a skeptic who's really willing to test. And as he points out, it's not hard to test this. Set up some basic scientific controls. Easy to do. It might not be super duper scientifically significant. We're going to publish it in some big report. But you'd know a lot doing this test, right? So again, I'm preparing for the interview with Stephen Novella. And I say, well, what's the follow-up to this? This is, you know, because the original interview is December of 05, right? There's got to be a follow-up. So I go into the Skeptics Guide forums. You can do this yourself. Type in Jan Helen McGee Skeptics Forum in Google. Google that and look what you come to. Okay, so somebody posts, you know, hey, I was wondering where the follow-up to this. This is on July 19th of 06. And then another guy says, I was wondering that too. And then Stephen Novella responds in the post something. He says, no follow-up yet. We're waiting for an appropriate local murder, but no luck so far. We're still waiting for a local murder. Okay. So again, you know, the rest of the crowd here is just kind of following along, kind of playing into this game that, yeah, we're really going to test this. So somebody says, listen to some of these things. It says, I live in New York and can offer you lots and lots of unsolved murders. Seriously, if that's the problem, just Google murder New York City. You'll have your stuff, right? Good. That's not too much of a leap, but true. Okay. And then somebody else goes, hey, yeah, she lives in the town next to me. It's not the murder capital of the world. She lives about 15 miles from the state capital and probably averages a murder a week. So, you know, there's plenty of murders. So this goes on and on, a few more of those, and then it just dies. There's no even attempt to test this. You know, and I have to say, Stephen Novella, I've spoke with him. I've listened to his show a lot. Seems like an intelligent guy, nice enough guy. But this is just a classic example of how the skeptics operate. Most of them don't even get this far. Most of them don't even approach the idea of doing research. But then to follow through with it, and again, as this points out, it's not that hard to do this, right? I mean, it's not that hard to test someone who says they're a psychic detective. You dig up a murder case, you give them some information, see what they come up with. They can't know every murder case in the country. So the protocol is very simple. And the same is true with medium research. You know, I described in the Skeptical Forums a personal protocol that I set up when I was first exploring this area for myself and doing my own research, which it took me a long time to build up the courage to say, hey, you know, I need to go talk to a medium and see if any of this stuff is really true. And fortunately, you know, I had read Gary Schwartz's book, and it really kind of provided me the structure for how to do it. And I'll describe it here to you now, and I'll offer this challenge. Anyone listening who's skeptical, who is open enough to go ahead and follow this protocol and do a reading with a medium the way that I've described, the first person who volunteers to do this, I invite you to do it, record the readings, and then come on Skeptico and prove me wrong. I'll put my money where my mouth is. I will actually pay for your readings to do it. So just contact me, the first one to do it, and we'll set it up and we'll do that. No problem there. But here's the protocol. It's real easy. First thing you have to do is you have to realize mediums run into the skeptic types all the time. So if you approach these people with some smart alecky, I'm going to debunk you kind of thing, they just don't want to do it, and the good ones just don't want to waste their time. First thing you'll find out, you'll be surprised when you call these people up. It takes a while to get in to see the best ones. But here's the protocol I want you to follow. Do this personal discovery and come on Skeptico and kind of prove me wrong. You're going to pick three mediums, and you want to try and find the best mediums you can. And I'll leave it to yourself to do that, but you know, you might really research around and find people that have worked on cases with the police or that are highly regarded. You don't want to pick someone who's a faker. If you think Sylvia Brown is outrageously expensive, but she's not a good medium, right? So don't pick her. Pick somebody who's really respected. Okay, so choose your mediums. You're going to probably wind up spending about $75 for a half-hour reading, and you're going to pick three of them. So it's going to cost you $225, and I'm going to refund you that money when you contact me first, and then you agree to come on the Skeptico Show. But even if you don't want to come on the Skeptico Show, here's how to follow the protocol. When you call up the medium, you explain to the medium that the most valuable thing you could get out of reading with them is personal confirmation of the validity of what they do. So you say, you know, you don't have any axe to grind with them. That would just be personally meaningful to you if you could get that experience. And that therefore, during the reading, you'd like to provide as little information as possible. You're going to give them your name. You're going to provide yes or no answers to their questions. But that you would really like to provide as little information as possible. Make sure that they agree to that protocol. I think you'll easily find mediums, if you're genuine in your pursuit of knowledge here, that'll agree to that. Then it's real simple. Go through, tape record the reading that you have with them, and at the end, objectively evaluate the data that they give you and match it to your personal experience. If you go ahead and research and look into Gary Schwartz's protocol, it's pretty simple. What you do is you really evaluate the information that they provided to evaluate whether it's specific information that is really kind of knowable, not that you're feeling good or you're feeling bad, but kind of, I see your deceased father figure and he has curly hair. Now, that's something specific. Either there's curly hair or there's not curly hair. He had an aggressive personality. Well, I mean, that is pretty specific. Either did or he didn't. So you go through and you just objectively score it, and then you have your little test. And now the reason I say pick three is because you're liable to find some readings, especially with this kind of controlled protocol that you're doing, that don't turn out so well. But I think if you do three, you'll find at least one that will at least severely challenge your skepticism about whether these people are tapping into any kind of real information. So there's a little challenge for all you skeptics out there to prove me wrong, prove that you're really willing to do some research. But the bigger point is that anyone can do this, right? And that's not a hard thing to follow. So where is the research? Where's the research? Where's the people? Hey, here's a great idea. Start a website. Say, hey, here are the psychics that I've tested. Here are the mediums that I've had readings with. Hear how horrible they are. Here's what fakers they are. Do it. There's nothing to stop you from doing it. But this will never happen because skeptics don't do research. And the reason they don't do research is that if you just do a little bit of research, you're not so skeptical anymore. You're at least open to the possibilities that there's a lot out there that's unexplained, that deserves a lot more attention. And that is what Skeptico has been all about. And it also brings me to the future direction of Skeptico. You know, based on everything that I've said during this broadcast, you can see that I've had a change of heart. I started out genuinely receptive to the idea that maybe the skeptics have a point. Maybe they have a position worthy of our consideration. But I found there just isn't much to it. So as much as I've enjoyed these interviews that I've done with some of the leading researchers into some of these controversial areas of science, and as much as I've learned, I feel like that's really not enough anymore. I started out this journey to see if there was any data there. Well, there is data there. So now the question to me is, why isn't this data being accepted? What is it about the system that we have in place that doesn't allow researchers to support this research, to do this research, and to get others to accept this research? And that's the direction that I want to take Skeptico. As you know, for the last several months, I've been talking about open source science and about getting an experiment going where I can replicate the work of Dr. Rupert Sheldrick. That's going to become my primary focus. And the primary focus of the Skeptico podcast is going to be to keep you informed as to how those research projects are progressing. Now, I know there's a lot of you out there who have enjoyed the interviews that I've done and see the many, many more researchers out there that I haven't had a chance to talk to who would be great guests. And I couldn't agree more, and I hope someone picks up that mantle and immediately goes and does that. I'd like to pick that up sometime in the future. The most important thing I can do right now is to put together and support the best research project I can into replicating some of this fine work that's already been done. And as I've told you, the project that I'm starting with is Rupert Sheldrick's Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home. As a quick update on that, it certainly seems like this phenomena is widespread. You talk to dog owners, you just go on a bulletin board of dog owners and you post that you're doing this research. You immediately get a lot of stories, a lot of accounts from people that seem credible, who are accounting for just routine and other things. It's much harder to find people to participate in a research study. Now, think what this takes. You know, you're going to have to be setting up video equipment in your home. You're going to have to take the time to do this over and over and over again. And you will have to have somebody who's already inclined to think that their dog is doing this. So I'm working on this. I'm confident that I will find people to participate. But this is the drill. This is what makes doing research like this tricky. It's not like the psychic research that I talked about, but again, our goal is different. Our goal in open source science and the project with replicating Dr. Sheldrick's work is to eventually turn this into university-funded, by me, scientific research that gets published and gets peer-reviewed and all that stuff. So it's a little bit harder to put something like that together. Hey, but the payoff's there too, right? I mean, I am going to get to see James Randi naked in Piccadilly Circus when we're done with this.
In my estimation, he knows full well the dog that knows its owners are coming home will not pass any test. Now, if it will pass the test, I will give him $1 million. I will give it to him in the middle of Piccadilly Circus naked, naked, naked. I will give it to him in the middle of Piccadilly Circus naked.
So there you have it. I'm sure you all stay tuned to how we go with the experiment, if for nothing else than to see that. What a conclusion for this experiment to look forward to. Well, thanks for joining me on this special Skeptico. I hope you'll stay with us as we continue to follow the data wherever it leads. As usual, if you'd like more information about the Skeptico show, like and would like to look through the archives of any of our old shows, or contact me via voicemail or email, please check out our website at Skeptico. That's SKEPTIKO.com. And until next time, bye for now.